All right, well, thanks for coming back. I'm glad I didn't scare too many of you away. Just to review a couple of comments that we saw that you had written. Most of them were quite positive, but I want to address a couple of the more negative comments, or negative in the sense of concerns. Put it that way, it's a better word. Someone said, well, I was looking more for a Bible study, and I kind of got a National Geographic special. And to be fair, I mean, many of you have been to Bible studies that I do, and you know me, I parse every word. We look at the Greek, and we parse the Greek verb. You know, I can do that kind of a Bible study, but this is a kind of a Bible study that's kind, you know, how many of you seen Star Wars? But then, didn't you want to see the making of Star Wars? Wait, see, this is kind of like the making of the Bible. In other words, we're going to look at some biblical text to be sure, but it is, to be honest, it is not a Bible study in the classic sense, but we are talking about the kind of theater of redemption, the stage, if you will, in which all of this was enacted, or shall we say, carried out by God. So it is by its nature. I'm not going to have lots and lots of Bible quotes. We're going to talk around, you know, some of the things that many of you already know about the Bible, certain stories and so on like that. My main event is to try to show you the kind of, if you will, stage or theater of redemption in which it took place. Secondly, regarding this being just more like I could have seen this on a National Geographic, that's true. Although I want to say that some of my sources, I'll show you the sources later, but I'm using some scholarly sources and also some more popular sources, especially for the pictures and so on. There's several books that I'm using. Some of them are rather heavy, you know, scholarly sources, and some of them are more, popular sources like National Geographic. And so I guess I should be flattered if you think it's like looking at National Geographic. They usually do a pretty good job. So, but anyway, just to explain, yeah, there's going to be a little bit of that in this. And I could get extremely scholarly and, you know, and things, but I think I want to try to aim for kind of where we all are in terms of our basic background, and not to become too stuffy, but also not too simplistic either. So aim somewhere for that middle, all right? So now, if you take your outline that it's on stapled on that same thing where the prayer thing was, just to sort of talk a little bit about what we did last week and catch up, we looked a little bit at the geography of the land. I didn't mention about the climate. I want to just say a few words about that today. How did the people of that time look? And what were Semites like? You know, you can't just say, well, of course, we all know what the Jewish people look like. No, that's not really correct, because they went to Europe and other places called the diaspora, the dispersion, and they intermarried and they took on a more of a European look. But the Jews of Jesus' time didn't quite look like Europeans. They didn't look like, you know, sub-Saharan Africans either, but somewhere in between. And you'll see a picture in a minute. If you weren't here last week, I'm going to real quickly run through the pictures again and show you some of those. And then we started talking a little bit about town and village life. And I want to finish that today and then get into the houses, what their houses were like. And then we're going to begin to look at some of the things about their clothing and the foods they ate and how they ate meals and things about personal hygiene and some other things that we'll begin to discuss. How far down the list we get is kind of up to all of us. If you have questions, or you know me, I'm a motor mouth, but I try to move through some of the material tonight. And but you have questions, you know, feel free to wave and ask. You know, I'll try to answer your questions as best I can. Okay, now with that in mind, let me just say a couple words about the climate while I've got the map up here, because I use this particular map because the topography has a lot to do with the climate. The climate here in this part of the Holy Land, which is only about 20 miles from this side of the Holy Land, are very different, very different. So we see that topography, namely the mountains and the valleys and the all of this has a lot to do with the fact that there's an overall Mediterranean climate in the whole area, but it's very localized differences. All right, so with that in mind, the climate of Palestine today and at the time of Jesus has basically two seasons. You know, we're used to four, but they have basically two seasons. There's the wet season or the rainy season, and it's from about October through April. And in April, somebody just turns off the rain. I mean, it just doesn't rain again until late September, early October. It's just the way it is in the Mediterranean. There's this big sort of high pressure that sets up out there, and you ain't going to see a drop of rain. all summer long. It's just not going to happen. So you can see how precious water is to them. Now, they collect every drop of water they can in the rainy season. All houses and buildings had these big cisterns where the water would run off the roof, and they didn't want any of that water to go to waste. It went down into that deep well or cistern that they dug. So they saved every drop because they knew they were going to have a rainy season, but then they knew they had to get through the dry season. So again, the temperature in the summer can get very hot. I was there, I think, in May, actually, and it was in the 90s. But it was wonderful. It was very dry heat, you know. It wasn't that bad. So, you know, here we have all that awful humidity, but there it's very, very dry heat. And likewise, there's a constant breeze that blows through the area being near the, and this is the way it is in the Mediterranean. So we see that it makes the summers very pleasant, and especially in the evenings, people love to make use of the evenings in the Mediterranean climate. Almost all, if you ever, any of you have been to any part of the Mediterranean, you know, the people, there's a lot of rooftop, you know, areas that people make use of because the climate is so beautiful, especially at night. With lower humidity, it gets cool at night, and even if it's hot during the day. So again, we see that though, as I say, throughout the summer, rain does not fall. All right. However, again, from about October through April, it does. Now, it doesn't rain every day, but that's when you get your rain. All right. This provides, of course, challenges for farmers when you have a really wet, or a rather wet, and then a very dry season. So. And again, because it doesn't get frigid, they're able to do a lot of growing in the wet months, but they get the crops started, and they do some irrigation and things to keep their crops growing. Okay. Now, it does get cool in the winter, and even occasionally in this area here around Jerusalem, you'll get snow. You've probably seen it in the news. They'll get some snow, sometimes even a foot of snow in Jerusalem and around Bethlehem. Now, that's rare. And it doesn't stay long, you know. It's wet and it melts within a day. But they do occasionally get snow. Now, way up here at the north in Mount Hermon, that's snow covered during the winter months, and it's the elevation is high enough there that they keep a snow cover up there. Okay, so it does get cool in the winter, and in certain higher altitudes near Jerusalem and Bethlehem, there's even snow. All right, now. The climate of the Holy Land varies a lot, you know, from north to south and east to west, as I've said to you, there's topography. So if you look here, this area here, there's a kind of an Appalachian Mountains, and they're about the same size as our Appalachian Mountains. And this area is called the Mediterranean Forest, because here, in this region here, is where there's some beautiful trees. I'll show you some pictures if you missed them last week. That grow here, and all this moisture, this is the Mediterranean Ocean here, all the moisture comes, and the mountains here sort of, like, you know how air is like a sponge, so when air comes and then it hits land, the land pushes the air up and literally squeezes the moisture out of it like a sponge, and so the water all falls there in that Mediterranean region, okay? Now right here though, suddenly, there's this rift in the earth, and I think I told you there's two plates pulling apart here, and tearing apart, and this is the lowest place on earth, the Dead Sea, that's not covered by ocean. 1,900 feet below sea level, all right? It's very, very deep, and then even the Sea of Galilee is 700 feet below sea level. You gotta go up to get to the Mediterranean. You gotta go uphill to get to the ocean, all right? It's a big tear in the crust of the earth. The difference between Jerusalem here and down here at Jericho, where I'm pointing now, is 3,500 feet, right? And the climate's incredibly different. It could be snowing up in Jerusalem and 70 degrees down at the Red Sea, at Dead Sea, I should say. It is a dramatic difference that causes. It is also one of the driest places on earth, not as dry as the Sahara, but it's very, very, very dry in the Judean desert, okay? Whereas up here, it could be raining and there's trees, and all of a sudden you're driving, here's Jerusalem, and you just go over the hill near Bethany here, and you start going down, and suddenly you drop into howling desert within 5 miles. All the trees disappear, and you're in desert. You know, some of us in the front row here, we made that bus trip, and the bus just went over the hill, and all of a sudden, where are the trees? Gone. Yeah. And the bus just went down, 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 down into the Dead Sea by Jericho. Now, near Jericho, there's an oasis here. And I'll show you a picture of that later on, but It's a very beautiful oasis, so there's some water down near Jericho. That's why there's a town there. Okay, but you can see that this is all this topography has a very strong effect. Now, you've got beautiful green trees over here. Over here, the Golan Heights, barren, rocky, almost no trees at all. And again, it's all about moisture. All the moisture gets squeezed out here on this rain shield, and then you have the rain shadow over here. There's just no rain on that side that falls. Not none, but very little by comparison. And I've showed you some pictures about that last week. Now, I know this is a review for a lot of you, but I just wanted to say something about the climate. Now, let me read you a couple of Bible quotes that describe the Holy Land, and it'll help to describe a little bit about a question that you might have. How many of you remember how the Holy Land was described to Abraham by God? A land flowing with milk and honey. And a lot of people who go to the Holy Land say, well, I wouldn't say it's flowing with milk and honey. It was kind of dry and brown, you know. Now, first of all, they probably went during the dry season. Secondly, maybe they were down in this area, you know, not up in this area over here where it's so beautiful and green. But again, so it depends on what you're looking at. But I want to just explain something to you. Let me just read the quote from Genesis. And explain something very strange to you that happened. Lot lifted up his eyes and beheld the whole plain of Jordan. That's over here. Okay? Now, right now I'm telling you it's a howling desert, okay? And he saw that it was well watered everywhere. Is Lot blind? Again, Lot, this is at the time of Abraham. Lot was the nephew to Abraham, right? Okay. Lot lifted up his eyes and he beheld the whole plain of Jordan. And behold, it was well watered everywhere. But then the text tells us this was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Even as the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt, you come unto Zoar. So again, there was a beautiful green garden-like quality to this region when Abraham first laid his eyes on it with his nephew Lot. And then, because Sodom and Gomorrah were right in this region here where the Dead Sea is now. And most archaeologists are pretty sure about that. Now, we're not absolutely sure, but there have been a lot of different ruins found there, and there's a lot of salt waste and things there now. What likely happened, remember I told you, these are two plates that are pulling apart, and this whole region is very volcanic, not in our lifetime, and even, you know, going back several hundred years. But you remember when Jesus was crucified, what happened? Terra tremuit, the earth shook. And the temple doors were swung open. Now, those things took 40 men to open. So that was an earthquake. You got it? A big earthquake. And it damaged the temple, and it damaged the doors, and the temple doors swung open, and one of them could not ever be closed. The whole temple was shifted. So it was a big earthquake. So there were earthquakes and have been earthquakes in this region. And even since the time of Jesus. Now, at the time, though, we think, you know, remember how God rained down upon Sodom and Gomorrah for their sins. He rained down, fire and brimstone, right. So, now, he doesn't mean that God didn't do it that way, but it's probably what was happening was something called a caldera blew up. It's a volcanic, Yellowstone Park is a caldera. If that thing ever blows, we're all in trouble, all right? So that's probably what happened. I'm not saying God didn't do it. I'm just saying he probably used natural things to bring it about. But that area ripped open and is certainly no longer a land of milk and honey. There ain't nothing grown down here and nothing alive in the Dead Sea. It's just dead as a doornail, okay? It says here that, but God had promised, you know, to the people. He said, the Lord said, I've seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and I've heard the cry of their taskmasters, and I know their sorrows. And I'm going to now come and deliver them out of the land of the Egyptians and bring them out of that land and into a good land, large and flowing with milk and honey. But again, today, that's sort of odd to a lot of us. It doesn't seem like it. Now, let me just tell you one more thing about the climate, and then we'll finish, and we'll get into some quick more review, and then there's a new material. The climate at the time of Jesus was quite similar to today, but there are important differences. It was probably a little wetter and a little cooler. Now, I don't say that just because of global warming and all that kind of stuff, but I'm saying it because there's been something that's been going on in the Holy Land. We were talking about earlier. It's called war. war. And because of all that warfare and other poor land management, an awful lot of the area has been deforested, especially over here on this side. The Golan Heights used to, they say that in Jesus' time, and the Romans used to get timber from the Golan Heights. Today, they're just barren hills. Likewise, even this range here, which has a lot of beautiful forest, it's not as thick and as rich, they think, as it used to be, based on archaeology. I mean, you call it, they take these core samples and all. So generally, we'll find that the climate is very similar, but it was a little cooler and a little wetter at the time of Jesus. And part of the reason for that is because of war and deforestation, poor land management, where they cut down too many trees. So right now in Israel, if you go there, you're going to find that there's a huge campaign to plant a lot of new trees. They're always planting trees, and people are buying trees. It's a big thing, and you can buy a tree and get it planted somewhere. Everybody wants to plant and get the land of milk and honey back the way it used to look. So they're working on it. It's going to take time, but that's the idea. So the climate is similar, but a little bit drier, a little bit cooler than when Jesus, and certainly when Abraham and Lot and others looked at it originally. Okay, any comments or questions about that? All right. Now, I want to just quickly review just some of the slides for some of you that weren't here, go through them rather rapidly that we looked at last time. But we did begin by looking at the topography of the land. And this is just a quick map. These are always the basic things in the basic features of the Holy Land. You've got the Dead Sea at the bottom, and then you've got the lake at the top where it says Capernaum. That again is the Sea of Galilee. It's really more of a lake, not a sea. But and then the Jordan River connects them, all right? And then you've got Jerusalem in the south, and you've got Galilee, and this is where Nazareth and Galilee, all that area where Jesus worked most of his public ministry up there, okay? There's our topography. This is just a little bit. See that green arch? That's the kind of Mediterranean forest that arcs around the Holy Land. Okay, this is an example of the variations of the how quickly the things change. This is the Sea of Galilee over near Cana. And you look across the sea to the Golan Heights, and you see how barren they are. See how that's just 5-10 miles. Not far at all. Now, again, I told you, in Jesus' time, there were probably more trees. Not lots of trees, but there were more trees that grew over there. And when the Romans came through during the war, they cut all those trees down to build siege works. And they just never grew back. This is a beautiful example of how Galilee is so green and beautiful at certain times. But you can sort of see off in the distance, there's some barren landscape, the Golan Heights again. This is down in the hill country of Judea. And most of you know that Mary went through the hill country of Judea to visit her cousin Elizabeth. And a few of us, I got some funny pictures of a few of us that went to the Holy Land trying to go up that hill. Remember, we were at Elizabeth's house, and I saw you all out of breath. And I was like, hey, what's the problem? But you can see, when Mary went through the hill country of Judea, we're not talking little you got that? These are Appalachian Mountains. And you know, she was pregnant. And then when they went to Bethlehem, they had to go back through these things. And she was 9 months pregnant. Are you praying with me, church? So here's the beautiful Mediterranean forest region. It's almost like our Appalachian Mountains. Now look, here we're going to go down next to right near Jericho and the Dead Sea. Whoa, what happened? And that's only 30 miles from what I just showed you. Yeah, just like that. Okay? Okay. I don't have a lot of time to develop all the political distinctions here, but again, you have here Jerusalem, Judea in the south, okay? You've got Samaria in the middle. The Jews didn't go through there. They go around it. They go out here, or they go over here, but they wouldn't go through it. Jesus went through because he loves everybody. And then you've got Galilee in the north. So you can see the northern part of Israel and the southern part are kind of divided by Samaria in the middle. And it's just the nature of things. And today, that's largely the area called the West Bank, where the Palestinians have their territory today. Now, this Decapolis region is a Greek, these were Greek and Hellenistic cities, very, very different from the Jewish cities over here. And I'll explain that later. Okay? All right, we talked about some of these things. This is just from space. That's the Sea of Galilee. Okay? And of course, you'll see in a second. But this would be where Capernaum was, right here. That was Jesus' home base. Nazareth is right over here, sort of off the map. And so all these little towns rung the sea here. Okay.
Now, this is a kind of a more traditional map. You can see where Capernaum is right there. Nazareth is way over here. See, that looks like a long way, but it's about you know, maybe 10 miles, not that far, 7 to 10 miles. There's Cana, where he worked his first miracle. Nain, where he raised up a young man who had died, the only son of a widow. And Bethsaida, Chorazin. Woe to you, Bethsaida! Woe to you, Chorazin! If the wonders I worked in you had been worked in Sodom and Gomorrah, they would have repented long ago. See? Woe to you, see? And how about you, Capernaum? Are you to be exalted to the skies? You will be cast down to the earth. For the wisdom of Solomon, the queen of Sheba, came. You have a greater than Solomon here. Jesus condemned these cities because of their lack of faith. This is... and by the way, they're all in ruins. They are. They did all collapse. Okay. This is just gives you a little bit of a sense of the topography of the land. See, all these rocky, they're not rocky, there are actually a lot of trees here. Very hilly regions. Nazareth is I think I told you this last week, Nazareth is like going to San Francisco. Very steep hills in Nazareth. You gotta have one leg shorter than the other. Just another picture of Galilee. This is where Jesus lived and worked. For most of those 3 years, he did go down to Jerusalem once each year, but his main work in those first 3 years was right up here in this region. Beautiful, luscious and green, but you can see very diverse as well. Another beautiful picture. Some of these towns and villages, we just looked at that earlier. Okay, the next thing we look at is, what did the people of that time look like? Now, the problem we have is that the Jewish people were religiously opposed to depicting the human person in art. They just didn't do it. They thought, oh my gosh, you know, God said make no graven image. Graven doesn't just mean, by the way, carved statues. Graven means, how do you print something? You engrave it. Okay, so even printing or drawing, as you see. So all of our Protestant friends who kind of say, hey, you shouldn't be having those statues in your church. Now, I don't want to get into that topic tonight. But even a picture in their wallet is graven. Pictures are, you have engraved something, you etched something onto the surface of paper. So it's all forbidden, okay? I mean, in the Old Testament. Now, since Christ came, we believe we're freed of that because Christ manifested God in human flesh. And since that time, the Christian church has felt free to depict Christ, the angels, the saints, and so on, as well as just human beings in general. But at the time of Jesus and going backward, they had a religious opposition to depicting the human person, whether in drawing or in carving or any of these things. So we just don't have any self-description. So what we rely on a little bit are some of the Egyptians had one picture. Now remember, this is a long time before Jesus lived, what I'm about to show you, this picture. And he looks more like an Egyptian, because Egyptians tended to see people that were looking like themselves. But nevertheless, this is a depiction by an Egyptian artist of a Habiru. That's what they called the Hebrews. Okay, but I think that the basic features, you can see the darker olive skin. This washes out a little bit on the screen up here, but on my screen it's an olive complexion, you know, not sub-Saharan, you know, brown, but certainly not white like my skin. Okay, so, and then the heavy beard, the dark thick hair, and so on. He's wearing what's called a loincloth. All right, and we'll talk about that a little bit more tonight. All right. Now this is a portrait of a. They found some skulls from Jesus' time. This is from Jesus. And you know, the forensic folks can do a lot of good work, and they build up the face using, you know, I don't know how they do it. You've seen it on TV, right? And so they took the skull and they looked at the facial features. Now they can't be absolutely sure of the complexion, you know, but they can certainly be pretty clear about the basic facial features. So you see there's strong, heavy facial features, not slender, kind of European, but again, heavy, you know, these were strong, sturdy people, these Semites. And the reason this is fascinating is that this is a skull from the time of Jesus. It was from around the first century where they found this skull. Okay? That just gives you. And this is just an artist representation of maybe that. Another one from one of the movies. Possibly. You know, again, it's not perfect, but again, the heavier features, heavy beard and so on. And with Mary, again, similar. It's not quite as accurate with her, but again, all of those are just ways of saying that to some degree, there's some attempt today to at least make them not look utterly European. You know, the Semites didn't look European, but neither did they look African. All right, then we moved into village life, and this is kind of where we began this, and I'll just begin again here a little bit about some village life. So let me read to you just a bit about some of the village life. By the way, just before we get into village life, can I read to you a description from Josephus, who lived in the first century, as he describes Galilee, where Jesus lived? He says, "Its nature is wonderful as well as its beauty. Its soil is fruitful, and there are all sorts of trees that grow in it. And the inhabitants accordingly plant all sorts of trees there, for the temper of the air is so sweet and mixed that it agrees very well with those, with all these sorts of trees, particularly walnuts, which flourish there. And they require cool air at night. And they flourish in vast plenty. And there are also palm trees, which grow best in the hot air. And there are fig trees, and there are olive groves, which yet require air that is more temperate." So he's fascinated that they get the cool air in the night and the warm air during the day, and it's very temperate overall. So all of these allow a variety of plants to grow. It says, "One may call this place the ambition of nature, where it forces those plants that are naturally enemies of one another to agree." Now, they can't get that with the human beings, but you know. "It's a happy contention of the seasons," and so on. He goes on to say that there are so many beautiful fruits and grapes and figs and wheat and so much that comes together in this beautiful land of Galilee. So that's Josephus's description of the beautiful land. Now, what were the villages like? Let me just read to you from some of my notes, and then we'll look at the pictures a little more. The Jews of Galilee, where Jesus grew up, were essentially a rural people. Most of Galilee was a farming region, or had orchards and vineyards and a lot of shepherds and animals and so on. Okay, so it was agrarian. The great majority lived in hundreds of small towns and villages scattered throughout the countryside, and they worked the land, and they tended their flocks, and they practiced their trades, and they seldom ventured more than a day's journey from home. Many did go to Jerusalem, sometimes as often as once a year, to celebrate the Passover. And that was no small journey. I told you that last week. 70 miles on foot, one way, from Galilee down to Jerusalem. And you see the kind of terrain that they often had to go through. Now, according to Josephus, I just mentioned him, a Jewish historian at the time, there were 240 villages around the Sea of Galilee at that time. But the average size of a village might be no more than a few acres, with a population of just a few hundred souls. Otherwise, the world was limited in their small little villages and the fields around it. And such a village might claim, as I said, no more than several hundred inhabitants who lived in modest one-story houses of stone covered with a kind of stucco. And you can see some of that here, okay? Basically, modest one-story. Some of them have a higher level, but basically, and that's stone, this kind of basalt that's very common in the region. But then they cover it with kind of a stucco. And sometimes they would paint in bright colors, too, which I don't care for. I don't like that. Now, it says here that, going on to read some of my notes for you, the houses tended to cluster around a town square, and in the town square were shops and an open-air market, and usually, this is what made it the square, some kind of a communal well or spring. So you see here in this picture, there's the spring. And they're lucky, because towns that had a spring, that was good water. If you had a well, not so good. Not so good. You know, sulfury smell, it's just not good. So again, all of these are just ways of saying that this would tend to make the town, the other houses cluster around it, okay? Now, each town, as I say, had a handful of local craftsmen, including the potter, the weaver, the carpenter, and the blacksmith, and a shoemaker. Because generally, those types of things couldn't be made in the home. But generally speaking, most of the men in the village went out to work in the fields, whether it was tilling or sowing seeds or pruning or harvesting. And to be clear, life was a long and difficult struggle against the elements, right? Because again, the climate can vary very dramatically there. Most families kept a small number of animals in their house, such as sheep and goats, which were useful for milk and wool, and eventually leather and food. Most villages also had a shepherd, or two or three or four, who tended the village flocks on the nearby hillsides. On many evenings, men gathered in the village synagogue, which in here, this is up here on the hill, on this picture, and
They would often study scripture and hear a service. And during the day, the synagogue also served as a school for the young men of the village who learned ancient Hebrew and studied the scriptures. Now, the young ladies just didn't do that. At this time, people no longer spoke Hebrew. So when the young men studied Hebrew, it was like me studying Latin. I've learned Latin, and I know I can read Latin, but I don't speak it every day. And that's the same way with them. The young men would go to the synagogue school, and they would learn just enough Hebrew to read the scriptures. But nobody spoke Hebrew anymore. They all spoke Aramaic. Now, you might say, hey, remember when we used to go to Mass and it was Latin? What were they thinking? That was a dumb idea. Why go to a service and you can't even understand what they're saying? That's just dumb. Okay, I got that. I hear all that. But that's exactly what they did in Jesus' time. You go to the synagogue and you'd go to the temple, and everything was being sung and proclaimed in Hebrew, and nobody spoke Hebrew. And some had studied it enough. They had a sense of it. Dominus vobiscum. Okay. But again, basically, they weren't reading Cicero, all right? They weren't reading, So again, there's just kind of an instinct among people that the language spoken in the church or the temple is not usually the language spoken out on the streets. Because people sense, well, church is different. It's a sacred place, and we use special words and special language. Now, right now, we're in an era where that's not the case. But throughout most of human history, the language spoken in the synagogues, the temples, in the churches, and even in the different pagan religions is not the same language spoken on the streets. It's just the nature of things. That's just the way it is. And you may say, well, that's just crazy. I got it. Spoken like a typical American, too. All right? But again, I'm just telling you that's the usual situation. I'm not saying let's all go back to Latin Mass. I didn't say that either. All right? Okay. Now, but again, since they didn't speak Hebrew, the young men were sent there to study a little bit so they could read the scriptures and proclaim them as lectors and do a little bit of study and generally do that. So they would do that a lot in the evenings in the synagogue. And most of the villagers also spoke Greek because it was the lingua franca of the day. As you know, like English is today, almost anywhere you go in the world, people can know enough English to talk to you. Come on, isn't that true? Almost anywhere you go. English is known almost by everybody as at least a second language. And it was that way with Greek in the time of Jesus. So Jesus probably spoke Aramaic at home, knew Hebrew in the temple or the synagogue, and then was also able to speak Greek because most of the people who weren't Jews, and by the way, only about 40% of the people in Galilee were Jewish. The other 60% were Romans and Greeks. So, and they spoke Greek. So Jesus certainly knew Greek. Was he fluent in it? Well, I don't know, but I'm sure he got by in it because it was the language of commerce. You had a question?
No, probably was.
Yeah, so Jesus likely spoke Greek, he spoke Aramaic, and he knew a good bit of Hebrew. Now I'm just talking about his human. The human, because as God, he knows. He doesn't even need language, all right? That's right, okay. Now, villages often sought well-protected locations. And I think I told you this last week, too. They usually built up on tops of hills. This picture is a little misleading because it looks like a valley. But usually they would build their towns and villages up on the tops of hills like this. Why would they do that? We talked about it. Protection. And also, this land down here is beautiful, valuable farmland. Why waste it with houses and animals and all that kind of stuff? So you put the towns up here where the land is less fertile, and you leave the fertile valleys for agriculture. Now, why don't we do that in America? Well, we've got a lot of land. You ever flown in an airplane? We've got a lot of open land. And secondly, we don't have the kind of, social unrest that they did. You could be minding your own business and, just the whole town gets wiped out. You needed fortified, protected areas to build your towns. Okay. Now, we also see that, so they generally built on hilltops rather than in the long sloping valleys. Now, larger villages were called towns, and they might be a little larger with 10 acres, and often they had walls around them, okay, for additional protection. Now, the streets were really they were more like alleys, very narrow streets. The homes that fronted on the streets came right to the edge. There were no front yards. You can see that here, right? There's your front door. Boom, you're on the street. You step right out into the street. Whoa, watch it, man. and get run over. Step out your front door. So no front yards. They found it right on the streets. Okay. And then the walls would be about 10 feet high. And then usually they would open up into a courtyard. You didn't walk right into a house. You sort of walked into a walled-off courtyard area. And in that courtyard were several other, like, rooms around there. And then there'd be flat roofs where people would use, like, an open second floor. Now, these look pretty empty. But you see this person here? I don't know if I'm blocking anyone's vision, but right here, he's up there doing some stuff on the roof. And you'll see in another picture, there's a lot more of that activity. People use their roof like a second floor, but it was open. And the Mediterranean climate lets you do that. All right. Villages tended to be small because of the needs of each village to be associated with pasture land around it and nearby. So each village depended both on crops and livestock. So if your village gets too big, it takes you too long to get out to the pasture land. So you keep your villages small and numerous, and then you have a lot of pasture land and farmland right nearby. So you didn't have to walk, you know, 4 hours to get to your farm. Okay? Each little village tended to be self-sustaining in terms of their basic needs. Occasionally, people would come from larger towns to provide specialized services, like, you know, sharpening knives and blacksmith stuff and specialty work, right? But generally, except for yearly pilgrimages, most Galileans did not travel far from their village on a daily basis. The little Galilean villages were rather distinct from the Greek cities of the Decapolis, and we'll talk about those. They were much larger, very cosmopolitan cities, very dramatically different than these little villages, and I'll show you some of those pictures. All right? Okay. Anything? By the way, Nazareth was considered kind of a hick town. And remember what Nathaniel said when he heard Jesus had come from Nazareth? Andrew said, what's that? Yeah, what good can possibly come from Nazareth? So it was just a little hick town. In fact, it was such a tiny little village that it didn't even have a road going to it, just a path. And so you see the idea. These were very small little villages. And I've told you this before many times, but they had an accent, a hick accent in Galilee. Just like, you know. And it made the people in Jerusalem kind of look down their nose, you know. And you got a funny accent. Yeah, I know. Amen, amen, I say to you, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. Jesus, this is not the way I imagined you saying it. See how humble Jesus was? Okay. All right. Now, let's get just a couple of other quick village scenes here. This is just zooming in a little bit on that picture. I've already shown you that. You see the spring. That's a very important part of any village. You see the women congregating there? You heard about that before, right? You know, you read about the woman at the well. She went at noon. Why did she go at noon? Yeah, she was an outcast. And you want to know what kind of gossip is going on, right? Oh, did you hear what's going on? Now, wait, I got news for you. The men over here, see, they're doing the same thing. if you were a social outcast, you'd go at noon. Nobody went to the well. It was hot. You go early in the day or late in the evening. But if you were an outcast, you'd go and you'd be left alone. See, that's kind of a sad situation she was in. Okay, but you got the spring. It was a social area. You see a beautiful olive tree here, see? And then right around that area of the well, you'd usually have some marketplaces. So you got this looks like olive oil sales going on. You see these little amphora things. They usually had olive oil. And I can't really see from here what that is, but you get the idea. And some of the families would be rich enough to have a nice cart. Most had a mule, but the really poor families couldn't afford a mule. But basically, it's kind of like today. Most people can afford some kind of a car, even if it's a jalopy. So if it's an old, broken down mule, but they got a mule, you know. So they would be able to kind of fetch some things from the market if necessary and so on. Now, you see, just outside of town, there's a flock of goats and sheep, and there'd be some shepherds. They lived in the town, but they would also take care of everybody's sheep. Now, usually, most people kept one or two sheep or goat right in their house. You say, that is gross. They might wonder why we keep dogs. Dogs? I mean, to them, dogs were wild animals, vicious. They'd like, they,
Jesus would be shocked if you have a dog in your house. Okay. But anyway, so, and they didn't have them in the living room. There was an area in the house to keep them. But other of the flocks were out here, you see. And because and that's where they needed to graze, you know. So you can't have all the sheep and stuff in the town because there's not enough for them to eat. So you bring a little bit of food for them, and most of them are grazing out here. And there's shepherds that are taking care. And we'll see when we look at shepherds. They were not a highly regarded group of guys. Poor guys, they got it bad. They really were, you know, they were treated bad, even though they did such an important work. Okay, I don't know what else to show you in this. Let's move on. Always wave at me if you have questions. Okay. This is just another same town, different angle. There you see the synagogue up there in the hill. And this is probably somebody's home, and right down here is kind of hard to see because it's dark. But there's a potter working here, and then over here there's a blacksmith, all right? And up here the guy's working on the roof, and he's, looks like he's pounding out a pelt of some kind. Yeah, tanning, yeah. In fact, that's a good thing you mentioned that. Tanners and blacksmiths tended to be on the outskirts of town because it was smelly work. And so that's kind of being depicted here. You got the edge of town here, and they're on the edge of town. All right. People did not like tanning. Okay, this is just a close-up of the synagogue. I showed you men would be on one side and women on the other. I got it back. You get the idea. There's a woman over there. There's a man here. And they would be seated around the edge, and there'd be the center desk where the Torah was read from and then commented. Now, you see the chair there? I'm standing to teach you. But in the ancient world, everybody sat. Any teacher sat to teach. It was a sign of authority. And so you think the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus is standing and talking, right? No, it says he was seated, and his apostles came to him, and his disciples gathered around him. You sat to teach. Okay. Now this is a rebuilding of the synagogue, the ruins of the synagogue that was found in Nazareth. So here's where Jesus would have attended when he was a youth. Now, this is not the synagogue. It is a model based on the ruins, all right? Now, you can see these buildings were rather dark inside because there were heavy stone walls, and they didn't have reinforced concrete like we do. So they had to build thick, heavy stone walls with small little windows at the top. And so they kind of were dark inside. Just honest truth, they were dark. You see these little steps? These were where people sat. They'd sit all around, and the instruction, the desk, and all that would be sort of right here off the picture, but That's how they would have looked. I'm sure it would have been painted. It wouldn't have been quite that dreary. Yeah. Okay. And this is just another village, a completely different village from the one we looked at earlier. But they're paying taxes here. You got the Roman officials. They're not pleased. These people are angry. They're in line. They're very angry. Look at all these people up here on the rooftop. That's very typical of a rooftop in the villages. Okay. Over here, there's another big, a lot of activity. People even put tents up there on their roofs, and they would sit under them, and they would talk till late in the night. Often they would sleep on their roofs and so on, okay? In the Mediterranean climate, that's a beautiful thing. You can see this house is kind of going up here on the hillside. I mean, this town is going up here on the hillside. Over here is a beautiful example of what they call terracing. And they would terrace so they would cultivate hills. And they were very, very good at this terracing. The Jews were well known for that. Had a lot of good stonemasons who did that kind of work, built their terraces. Okay, continuing on. Just a quick close-up of the town there. Okay, I'll move on. We saw much of this last week. This is kind of the market area, if you can make it out. But here you've got some jugs, and this is probably where they're dispensing wine. People are going there to get wine. Over here, I think if I look closer at the picture, my computer is olive oil. And they would often have the market, and then they up on the roof, you know, the family would live right behind, and they would use the roof like their home and so on. Here's the well. In this case, it's a well, not a spring. You can see that most of these towns are small. They just have little paths leading to them. Okay? There's a mule. Mules are very important. How's a mule different from a horse? The main thing, a lot of times they look very similar, but they have big ears. Yeah, that's a mule. Okay? Big ears. All right. All right. Again, just some more. This is a market scene. Now, this should not be in a village. This would be in a larger town. And again, you can kind of get the idea. They're hawking their wares. You've got some very expensive, only rich people could afford dyed cloth. You know, you just had to have a lot of money to get that. You know, you just did. Okay. This would be a much larger town that actually has a gate, you know, a wall and a gate. And you can see the Roman soldier here is making his authority to be felt. Yeah, in some of these larger villages, they would have stone pavements, and the Romans were famous for that. The Romans were famous for their pavements. They last even to this day. Okay, this would be kind of a close-up of olive oil. This is an olive oil press. They're squeezing the olives, and it's kind of hard to see, but there's a little trough that comes into this little area, and all the olive oil accumulates, and they pour it into these vessels, and then to these over here, and then they sell it in the front room here. So it'll be a typical olive oil press. And a lot of larger towns and villages had these because it was a service. In a small village, however, most families had their own olive press. And the women would just collect olives and press out the oil themselves and collect it. And they might go to a local village, local town, to get some or buy some. But more often than not, in the smaller villages, they would just do it on their own at their home. Okay? Okay, now we're going to come to a real town. These are all just artistic representations. This is what Capernaum looks like today. You say, what a mess, Father. And that is, what you're really looking at here are the foundations, you know. And sometimes under foundations you have supporting walls and things that aren't part of the outside walls. So that's why it's so confusing to see all these stones. Well, where were the walls and where were the doors? And I can't figure it all out. But you know how you sometimes have footings under your own house? And so that's, a lot of these aren't just, you know, walls or footings that hold up the floor and so on. All right. This ugly building here is that church. I just wish they hadn't have built it, but as I said, that's the church I mentioned to you. It's over Peter's house. Now, you know, most of us have this idea that when you find an historic place, you try to preserve it as it was. And if it's all been destroyed, you try to find out how it was and you rebuild it the way it looked. But in the ancient world, up until very recently, no, that's not what you do. You tore the whole thing down and you build a church on top of it. Now, that's going to be important because I'm going to show you how we know what Peter's house is. All right? This modern church is really just another church built on top of a much more ancient church, which was built on top of a very special house in Capernaum that was called the House of Peter. Okay? So let's continue to look. Now, this map you have in your notes, because I didn't know how well you could see it on the screen. You want to refer to your notes, you will see it. But I want you to see, this is an area that's been excavated. Now, since this drawing was made, they've done a lot of excavating over in this other area. It says here, architectural A to F, architectural fragments and so on. This has all been excavated now too. And so it's all being done. But this synagogue is a very important synagogue. There was something said in this synagogue, and you can stand in the ruins of the synagogue today. And I stood in the ruins of the synagogue, and I wept, because I knew what happened here. And a lot of things, Jesus preached in this synagogue many a time, but one of the last times he preached in the synagogue, he said, I am the bread of life. Whoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood remains in me, and I in him. And I'll raise him on the last day. But at this, the Jews grumbled among themselves and said, how can this man give us his flesh to eat? This talk is hard to endure. And Jesus said, does this trouble you? What if you were to see me going up into glory where I come down from? He says, I want to solemnly assure you, unless you gnaw on the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. And then many said, this is crazy talk. And it says, many left him that day and would no longer walk in his company. Because he spoke this way. And he turned to Peter, whose house is right up the street. He said, Peter? He said, well, he turned to the 12. He said, will you all leave me? Lord, where would we go? You have the words of eternal life. I don't really know what you're talking about, Jesus. But, you have the words of eternal life. So that all happened right here. Now, the ruins of the synagogue that are there today is from a later period, but they're built right on top of the synagogue where Jesus spoke, and you can go outside and see the foundation stones of that synagogue. It's an amazing place to be. Just to think of all the things that happened in Capernaum, all the healings, all the miracles. It's an incredible place to go. If you ever get a chance to go, sell everything you have and go. Now, the ruins of Capernaum are referred to as, we would call them blocks, blocks. In Latin, they call them insulae, which means literally islands, but it's what we mean by blocks. All right, so there's a block here, and there's a little narrow road, and a road on all sides. So that's a block, just like we think of a block. Here's another block, and this block is interesting. It's not just, it's an insula sacra. And notice these funny octagonal, hexagonal things. You've got that? That is the ruins of a church that was built in the 3rd century, just after the persecutions ended. And it's built on top of another ruins, which is the ruins of Peter's house. Now you say, how do we know that's Peter's house? Well, because the Christians, who had always preserved that memory, had continued to worship in Peter's house, and we have documentation of that. And then when they could, they put the larger church on top of it. But they'd always known that place and worshiped in Peter's house quietly and secretly in Capernaum. Okay? So this was kept alive in the memory of the Christians. This is Peter's house, and we know where it is today. And it's very well documented. I don't have time to show you everything about it, but now, here's a kind of an artist representation of what Capernaum probably looked like. It's not hard, it's not easy to see that. Maybe in your, I think you have it in your notes. Can you flip the page and, Okay, that might help you to just see it a little bit better. But, again, here's the synagogue that I mentioned to you, okay? And then right up the street, this is Peter's house right here. Oh, that's Peter's house. And Peter's house, as you notice, he's a fisherman. And he had his little dock right there on the Sea of Galilee. And the fishermen would build these little, what do they call those, eddies? They'd build them out there. And now, by the way, Peter was not a dirt poor man. And neither were, especially James and John were not dirt poor. And they were also very politically connected. They were, somehow, we don't know exactly how, but they were friends of the high priest in Jerusalem now. That's kind of like being friends of our president, you know what I'm saying? So James and John and the Zebedee Fishing Company, they were also here in Capernaum. What's that? Oh, I didn't hear what you all said. Okay, but anyway, this may have been, we don't know for sure, James and John's, you know, the Zebedee's house, the Zebedee Fishing Company, we don't know for sure that, but we're quite sure this is Peter's house, and this was his fishing area. And these were not poor men. Now, they weren't wealthy, but fishing was a pretty lucrative profession. If you know, it had its ups and downs. But basically, these were not poor men. Okay. Yeah, Matthew was a tax collector. He was definitely not a poor man. All right. So we looked at Capernaum. Now, this is just another maybe artist representation of Capernaum again. It's a little bit different, but there's a synagogue again. Up the street, here's Peter's house. Here are the boats. Doesn't show the docks, but there it is. Okay, some of these, just showing you, we can sort of see the outlay of these cities as we look at the ruins. Now, you can see how very simple, though, and plain these villages were. I just want to show you quickly, the Greeks and the Romans built very different villages and towns. I mean, they built these massive, you know, it's like going down to Constitution Avenue and seeing our big buildings, you know, with all the columns. That's how they built their towns, all right? So this is a gate to a town in the Decapolis, and the name of the town is today it's called Jerish, but it was called Gerasa. Jesus went there, and that's one of the areas where he might have healed the Gerasene demoniac, right? Gerasa. Remember the man who was among the tombs and couldn't be restrained? And he ran over the bluff. So this is one of the cities of what's called the Decapolis, which means 10 cities. Okay? And these 10 cities, they all spoke Greek, they hated Jews, but they do business with them. Okay. And the Jews hated them, but they do business with them. And very, very monumental cities. This is how the Greeks and the Romans, they feel very proud of them. This is Rome. And so here's what the main street looked like. Now it's in ruins, of course, but you see it's all paved, and you've got these magnificent columns, and behind the columns were buildings and markets and a big, big, bustling kind of town that Gerasa was, okay? And this is just another, this is one of the big government buildings that we just have the ruins of today. Here's probably what the area looked like when it was in good repair. But you see, beautiful, beautiful. See how different these are than the simple little villages that the Jewish people lived in. And by the way, the Jewish people thought that this is decadent. And likewise, the people who lived in towns like this couldn't imagine living in those shanties over in Galilee. And here's just another example of just kind of what the streets would have looked like. And this is all the same town of Jericho. Okay, now let's go into a typical home. This is somewhat new material. Let's see how far we get. And let me check the time. Okay, yeah, we're getting close. But let's try to get through looking at this house. You have a picture. You have a flip through, you'll find this picture in your collection. If it helps you, you may find it better to look up here. But if it helps you to see. Now again, obviously there weren't holes in the roof. This is for our sake that the artists have cut these holes. But again, notice again, a typical house with front on the street with about a 15 foot wall. And you go through the main doors, which could be barred at night. And then you walk not into the house per se, but you walk into a courtyard. Okay? And on either side of the courtyard, and there weren't always perfect rectangles, but there it is. There would be access to different rooms. But there was always this open courtyard in the larger homes. Again, remember the climate, and they wanted to take advantage of it. Okay? So what you do. Now, and again, because roofs are expensive to maintain. Now, you would go in the courtyard, you would have an area. Now, that shows like a well, but that's awful lucky, man. That's just luck. Most people didn't have a private well. I know what that is. I'm sorry, I'm not looking closely. That's where they would do some cooking. Okay, now, you would have a kitchen area, but you almost never cooked in the kitchen because it was inside, and you wanted to vent the smoke. And so you would usually cook either in the courtyard or outside the house, all right? And I'll show you that later when we look at that. So the kitchen would store utensils and things like that. There might be in larger homes a dining area. I don't know if you can see, but that's a pretty low table. They did not eat at tables like we do. They ate on the floor, reclining on their elbow with a low table. Okay, and I'll show you that later. Over here, it's kind of hard to see, there's a little storage area. This would be kind of an area where there's some beds. Now, that shows beds. You're going to see, they don't really have beds like we do. They would roll out mats. Yeah, they rolled out mats. All right. And by the way, that means they could roll them up during the day and use the room for other stuff. All right. And a lot of times, they would sleep up on the roofs in the better weather. And so this room could be used for a variety of purposes. That's the point, right? Now, by the way, not a lot of privacy. We'll talk about that later. Now, it's hard to see, but most homes did have what's called a mikvah, which was a bath. Didn't have running water. You would fill it with water, but they took a combination of ritual baths and also regular baths. And it would have required a lot of work, but these were not people who didn't bathe. A lot of us think, oh, those people in the old days, man, they must have stunk. They never bathed, you know, they never bathed. That's just not true. In fact, over and over again in the Bible, there are mentions of bathing and the importance of being clean and so on. So, again, it's even smaller homes. This is a fairly mid-sized home, all right? The poorest of the poor probably would have had more of one basic room with a kind of a lean-to outside, but this was not uncommon that a typical family could afford. And usually there might be several families together. I don't say several, I mean several generations. You might have grandma and her children and a couple, you know, her grandchildren. Maybe three generations, okay? Now, but there would be, I don't know if you can see here, but there's kind of like a little storage area and some closets and just a little gathering room here. But you see these steps? Very important. All this roof area up here. Again, there's no holes. The roofs, obviously, in the real house. And they use these roofs. See this guy? He's working on the roof. Every year, just before the rainy season, they would get up and they would make some pitch and they would seal their roofs for the rainy season. And so what he's doing there, these were made out of wood trusses, and then they would be heavy, not just real light, but real heavy straw mats. And then those straw mats were filled with pitch, kind of a more like stucco than mud. And they would just pile that stuff up there, and they would work it with these rollers, make it good and flat, and they made sure that the water could run off so it didn't puddle up there. And they were very good at it. And by the way, you can't really see it here, but they would be very careful to catch every drop of runoff into a cistern, just a big area to hold water underneath the house so that when the dry season came, they'd have extra water, okay? So all of these are just things that I hope you can get. Now, by the way, see the animals here? And again, most houses did keep their animals. Now, there were a couple of different ways this was done. Some of them were done like this, where they'd actually have a certain room off the main courtyard where the animals were kept. Other houses would have, maybe if they were on a hill, they would have like a cave underneath. Does that sound familiar?
Familiar.
Where the animals would be kept. So in Bethlehem, which is a very steep, it's built up on steep hills. If you go to Bethlehem, it's like, again, it's like San Francisco. And so you have a house, and then you, on the back side of the house, the hill is sloping dramatically down. You go down one level, and underneath there's a caved out area for the animals. You keep your animals. And that's where Jesus was born. Okay? So technically, he wasn't just born out of some lonely stable. He was born in somebody's house, not in the best part of their house. He should have been born up in here, see? But he was over here with the animals. Okay, but it's not, you know, you need to understand, if you go to Bethlehem, you'll see that these houses are up in these steep hills, and there's one level, and the back door opens up to a very steep incline, and underneath is a cave area where they have animals and other things they store, okay? Questions or comments about this? I don't know if you can see up here on the roof, something's being done, I can't really... Anyway, it looks like something's being done up there. But there's a little conversation going on over here. Rooftop life was... isn't there a song or two about up on the roof? So, here they are up on the roof. Up on the roof. Father, don't. Okay, but you can see that they're having a discussion. This was common. People went all... They would stay up quite late. And when they weren't really... By the way, when you're a farmer... You have really busy times, and then you have times you're kind of waiting. And so this was the type of, you know, okay, let's try to get through a few more, and I got to begin to wrap up. So this is a mikvah. Now this is a double mikvah. Most houses wouldn't be able to afford a double one. But I mean, when I went through, some of us went through Nazareth, remember they were even in a little house that Joseph and Mary had, there was a mikvah. I mean, so don't think they didn't ever bathe or, you know. Now, you say, well, Father, where was the latrine?
In the mikvah.
No, not in the mikvah. Don't do that. Do not use the mikvah. This is in Nazareth. This is the one in Joseph's, right off of Joseph's workshop. It may well be the one Mary and Joseph used. Mikvah. You go down these little steps, and there's just a lot of water in there. You just immerse yourself, and you cleanse and bathe. Now, exactly how it drained, I can't remember, but they show you. There's a little, like, trench that goes off. And again, I hate to say it, but they didn't exactly, not everyone had clean bath water. I mean, you know, the whole family would bathe, you know. Now, I know none of you ever use the same bath water for all your kids. Now, to answer the question, where were the bathrooms and so on, and the baño, where was the toilet? Usually it was outside, and it depended a little bit. Most villages had kind of an area. Yeah, and it was an outhouse, basically. And there was discreet. It wasn't like, you know, everyone just, you know, walked into some big open area. But most villages, you'd be surprised how very little is said about this. Any of the literature, because the Jewish people were just very discreet about this. One spoke of the latrine. Now, the word latrine means an area where one washes, but it also means an area off to the side. So, obviously, you wouldn't, in those eras, keep something like that close to your house, because, well, you get the idea. Even when some of you were older than I, when I remember when, you know, outhouses were still sometimes found in rural areas, you certainly didn't put it right up next to the house. And it certainly wasn't in the house. You made a little trek across the yard because it had its
moments.
Yes, it had its odors. Okay. Here's just a kind of a picture of a typical house scene. Here's a woman. She's out here kneading dough, making bread. Unfortunately, the picture cuts off. there's a little fire burning here, and she's baking bread. Look at all these animals. These are the house, you know, the animals they keep near the house. So you've got a couple sheep. There's a mule, and I can't see it there. I think there's a goat in the background. Okay. And there's a chicken too. And by the way, they did not eat a lot of chickens. They didn't eat eggs at all, as far as we can tell, in Jesus' time. Almost never did they eat eggs. So it just wasn't common there at that time. All right. Now you also see this is the kind of an oven. Notice it's outside. And so she's kneading the dough, making the bread. There's also a little like pit fire there and an oven. And there's a thing to put the bread in. So they would cook outside for obvious reasons. They needed ventilation. Or in the courtyard. In this particular house, it's hard to see the guys looking, the father, the husband's looking out the back door, not being very helpful. Okay, now, let's look at a real house. Peter's house. What did Peter's house look like? Whoops, I didn't press the right button. Now, this is a kind of a quick mock-up of Peter's house. Now, we're going to look at some other shots in a second. But this is the street. And there's a doorway that you come into. There's a courtyard. So you see the typical arrangement, right? I think some of you might have that. Okay, yeah. This open courtyard wasn't just because they ran out of money. These were used for things like cooking and other outdoor things, and it was pleasant.
And
children. Yeah, children could play there, any number of things. Okay, now notice again all these rooftops. This shows them as blank, but in Peter's time, frankly, it would be full of stuff. Yeah. You'd have little tents up there, you'd have all kinds of little things up there. So, you know, like your garage, right? Mm-hmm. Doesn't your garage look that clean? Look at that. Okay. But anyway, so you see the steps going up to the rooftop. Now, here, if you come in, there's a large room here, and it was probably in Peter's time, the dining room area, they call them the triclinium. They didn't speak Latin, but you know, the basic idea is this would be like an area they could use for dining or other gatherings. This is from what we can tell, this would have been the area where they would have had the beddings and other types of things. And there's some storage areas here and a kitchen area over here. Okay, over here was an opening. It doesn't really show it here, but there's an opening to the sea that takes place here. Where they would have had the boats and other things out here. Okay? Now, let's begin to look around Peter's house a little bit. So you come in the door and into the courtyard, okay? And we look around. So we're looking, the street's behind us, and we're looking inside now, and we see off here in the distance, probably the mikvah, the bath area. In here is that larger room that I mentioned to you that might have been used for beddings. The dining room would be way off the picture here at this other end. And over here, yet another room that was probably used either for storage or other things. We're not sure. This is the general courtyard, and then all this rooftop area. The steps would be sort of over off the picture here. Okay.
All that stone wall?
Yes. Oh, by the way, about the stone. The stones probably wouldn't have been exposed like that. They would have probably covered them with stucco. And then painted them, or you know, kept them kind of a white or a gray, you know, like a light gray. Okay, does that make sense? I mean, so this is kind of a basalt that's common in the region. I don't know why this artist left it open like that. It's almost unimaginable that they would have done that. They always put some kind of a stucco. By the way, for good reason. It was just cosmetic. You know, kept the water and stuff from getting in these stones and beginning. They didn't have the kind of mortar that we have today. Right? You got to protect these. All right, so here's looking in a different direction now, sort of off to that bedroom area I said, and then you know, just some things that are kept out in the courtyard. Okay, this is looking, remember I told you how those stairs go up to the roof? Remember we saw that? You can look at your own thing and see kind of where we're looking now. And you get there's another big large room area in here. And again, exactly which they were used for. Was this the sort of dining area or sleeping area, or was this? We're not absolutely sure. However, we do know later that this room was used for mass. Okay, this is that back area that I told you that opens up to the sea. And some boats here, and you probably had a dock out here, you can't see it, but this is sort of an open area behind the house. It's kind of hard to see on this boat. Yeah, that little back area there, okay? Okay, so you sort of see that, okay? Just kind of giving you a flavor. Now here, let's go inside one of the rooms, one of those two larger rooms. Now, this is where they would have eventually ended up holding mass. Now, here's where Jesus probably was when they opened the roof and dropped the paralytic down. This area is today underneath the altar of the church. Up above would be the church now, okay? Now, you notice again, they stucco walls and they would often paint kind of a red wainscoting or something there, all right? These stone lintels. Sometimes these were made of wood, though. Now, this would have been a larger gathering area for people. They could have rolled out mats and slept in this room in cooler or wet weather. They could have used it for a dining area. They can kind of use it because, you know, we have a lot of furniture that limits us. But they were just very, let's roll out mats and sleep. Or let's put up a couple of, they would sometimes just have these very easy to port low tables where they'd lean and have. And they weren't even sometimes made of wood. Sometimes they were just piled up blankets. Some of us went to a restaurant in the Bedouin area. And those weren't even really tables. They were kind of like these heavy pillows that we sat on. And so just a lot of pillows and things, and we pitched around, and we you know, ate in the Mediterranean style, you know, eating on our left elbow, eating with our right hand. Okay. I know it's getting late, so let's keep. This is just another angle from that room. You can kind of see some more pillows off in the background, and some of this. And again, later on, after the Christian church was underway and Peter had gone home to the Lord and all that, this was used up until about the 3rd century secretly, but it was used for celebrating Mass. Okay. All right. This is just another home that they've excavated in Capernaum. It's similar to Peter's, but you can see the same basic layout, right? You enter in from the street, there's the steps up to the roof. You've got a kind of a couple courtyard areas here, and all these rooms that open. This is not Peter's house you're looking at. It's another house. I label it, this is a house in Nazareth. Now, it's a little smaller, but here you come from the street. You enter into this open courtyard area. It's a small one. It's more of a narrow. But on this side, there's some rooms, and there's some weaving going on in here. Over here is a kitchen area, or, you know, where they were served. This is area back, and here's a mikvah. And again, it's a small house, so they would probably sleep in this room as well as do other activities when they couldn't sleep up on the roof. Okay. So you see, it's a little smaller, but it's the same basic setup. Okay. By the way, Mary's house that's been excavated in Nazareth, we're pretty sure we know where that is, because again, the Christian churches that were built over there had an interesting effect. And you might think this is awful, just terrible, I can't imagine that. But what happened is they would hollow out a cave, and then the front part of the house was a kind of a built out area. And the back part went into a cave. He said, ew, gross. But it was actually very nice. It was cool and kept things, you know. So you say, well, this is just awful. But again, we're used to different things. Mary and Joseph were not poor. They were not rich. But they were, we might call them the working poor. Okay. This is just, by the way, that house we just looked at, that's what it looks like today, the ruins of it. So they've... See there. By the way, remember I mentioned about the mikvah? There's one of them going down into the... Okay. All right. And then here... Oops, I went too quick. So that's just another... I think I already showed you that. I don't know why I got on there twice. Sorry. And this is just a picture of a kitchen. And when I say kitchen, you're expecting appliances. You're expecting appliances. But it's really an area where you store the kitchen utensils and things. And we'll talk more about these in a future thing. Well, I thought I might get a little further today. It's pretty late, and I think we went over time, didn't we? But listen, real quick preview for you. We're going to go next into some daily life at home. So let's look at some of them. I'm just going to real quickly run through some pictures, just real quick. I'm not even going to talk much about it. We're going to look at some of the animals they had. There's a donkey and a mule, and a goat, and a sheep, how they live close to their animals. And then we'll look a little bit at their clothing. I thought I might get to that tonight, and didn't. Now, that's... They would wear, real quickly, just since I did happen to bring some clothing with me to show you, but that's why I'm wearing my cassock today. They wore an inner tunic and an outer tunic, okay? That's kind of the clothing they wore, the basic clothing. So the inner tunic would have been like this guy on the left. And sometimes in the earliest years, they were shorter like that. They'd have short sleeves and they were shorter, kind of almost like a kimono, what do you call that thing? And they would bring a little, like a little belt around it. In later years, though, these became almost like what I'm wearing. They had long sleeves, and they had, they came to the ground, the inner tunic. And then, that's kind of, that's their underwear. Now, this is, they would, over that, they would put outerwear. Namely, an outer tunic, or a mantle, they sometimes called it. And we'll talk about that more, but if you, let me just show you something. No, there's nothing being worn under that. That's the underwear.
This is the zone.
Yeah. Yeah, they didn't wear tight-fitting clothes like we did. They just didn't do it. Let me show you something. Because you don't see this every day at Mass. You see it. You see it. I'm going to just show you. I'm in my underwear right now. Now, they would have never worn, you know, black under tunic.
But over that, they would say, well, I'm going to go on out, start my day. So they would just throw on an outer tunic, what I'm about to do. And they just throw it on. The one, the guy there on the right, see? They just throw it on. So, good. All right? And then they would gird. They would gird themselves.
Now, gird means to put on your outer garment.
It doesn't just mean, but it also means to put on your belt. So you didn't go out, because these were large, billowy garments. See that? By the way, they're helpful because when you go to the market, but anyway, so they would put on their cincture. Now, usually you can see they had wider belts than I'm putting on now, but you get the idea. They put on this, and the purpose of it was because this kind of gathered the garment. It looked better, but it also made sure that the thing didn't just blow all over the place, okay? All right. Then on top of that, they might occasionally, in colder weather, they would put on like an overcoat or a mantle. Now, there's two different ways. Sometimes they would just sort of wear a mantle that they could kind of carry like over their shoulder like that. But usually in colder weather, they would actually put on a poncho like. This is just a vest. But they'd throw over a, you know, kind of a poncho. Sometimes it had a hole through the head like this. Sometimes it was just more of a very large, oversized scarf that they would wear like a mantle, and they could kind of cover, you know, or a cape, right? So this would be, in cooler weather, what they would do, okay? Now, I'll show you this again next week if some of you weren't here, but that's the basic, what you're looking at, okay? Now, if somebody is dressed like this in public, they're said to be naked. Now, you hear about Peter being naked in the boat?
Right.
He was not naked. He wasn't butt naked.
I lost my microphone.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, let's talk about that. Yeah. What's going on here now? Okay. Okay, her question is, they always wore clothes that breathe, and that's a very good observation. You know, I think we moderners have lost some practicality, especially because we live in a very hot climate, but we wear these tight-fitting clothes, and they don't really... How many of you have ever had the opportunity to wear linen, real linen?
Yes.
It is the most magnificent one. Now, it wrinkles. You just look at it, and it wrinkles.
Yes.
But it is wonderful. It's like natural air conditioning. These would usually be made of a kind of a coarse linen, but oh, they were cool. And because they were loose-fitting, they breathe, and it breezes. And then this one top is also loose-fitting. Are you praying with me? Very practical clothing. You say, that's kind of strange. I don't want to walk around with all the robes on. Because it was practical. People didn't even know about pants in that time. Pants were invented maybe 300 years ago. Pants are a relatively new invention. Now, there is a problem, and the reason pants were invented, by the way, is when you start doing a lot of manual work like we started doing in the industrial age, you need your legs free. Now, this kind of a garment, you know, you get all tangled up and fall and trip, right? So, some of you heard me say this before, when the Bible says, gird your loins, ooh, that sounds, Father, are they talking? That's kind of personal, isn't it? So I think I've shown some of you this before, but to gird your loins, because you're going to be, it's like roll up your sleeves in modern language. you have to have your legs free if you're going to be doing a lot of lifting and walking up steps. And so you gird your loins means you pull up your garment and free your legs, and then you pull your belt tight. So I didn't do it much, but I, you know, yeah. To gird your loins means to pull up your garment, free your legs,
so
you're able to, yeah, to move or work. Yeah. So it's a symbol of work. It means roll up your sleeves. Now, because in these garments, beautiful though they are for that kind of a climate, they're very impractical if you're having to do a lot of work that gets going up and down steps. And, you know, I wear the cassock enough to know that I had to reach down and pull up my cassock if I'm going up steps. But, I mean, you know, what I'm saying is that when they were going to be doing a lot of stuff where their legs needed to be free, they would gird their loins, they'd pull up their garment, tighten their belt, and be ready for work. Okay, that's what that means. So these are some real quick things. We'll get back into clothing and look more at it next time. But I just wanted you to get the basics, all right? Now, by the way, another thing about nakedness. When they would speak of someone being naked, this is really what they meant on the left. They didn't mean people walking around butt naked. For example, Jeremiah was said to have preached naked for 3 years. Jeremiah wasn't running around butt naked. He was not wearing his outer garment. And that was considered scandalous, but it wasn't like we think of naked. Secondly, when Peter's in the boat, he wasn't butt naked either. Finally, I think, and there's a lot of people that think that crucifixion, people who were crucified in the nude. I think the Jewish people would have rioted. I don't think so. I think they certainly had on some kind of a tunic or a cloth that at least covered the areas that needed to be covered, okay? I'm very doubtful. I know that some scholars are divided. They thought that the Romans were trying to humiliate. Okay, I get that part, but I don't think the Jewish people would have stood for a moment public nudity of any kind. They were very discreet about these things, okay? And these clothings are very easy and quick to wear, but you would never go outside your house, you know, wearing your without your outer garment. If you just had your inner garment, that was considered disgraceful, and you were considered naked, but not literally.
Well, can we assume in the first reading, the angel says to Peter, put on your mantle, could you assume that it was cold?
Well, yes. Mantle could just be the outer tunic. It could have been an additional garment, but I'm guessing that Peter had his outer tunic off and was just sitting in his inner tunic, which you could do inside and among your family. That was all right, you know. I don't know what you all do in your homes, but sometimes men will walk around in boxer shorts and a t-shirt, you know, or at least, you know, a t-shirt. Whereas, you know, you wouldn't go out of the house that way. You know what I mean? So they could be more comfortable and relaxed in the home, but you never went out in public without your outer tunic on. Okay? That's the idea. Yeah. Yeah. She's talking about the Sodom and Gomorrah and how the scientists or archaeologists have found like large salt pods.
And they found a mother and a cow.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and it probably wasn't actually Lot's wife, but anyway, I get what you're saying. Well, the fact is that we're pretty clear where the region of Sodom and Gomorrah had been. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's something about the current that shifts and causes the tides.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, they're trying to come up with natural explanations for the miracle of the parting of the Red Sea. All right, fine. I mean, however God chose to do it, but God's always right on time is the main point. Okay, so we're going to be looking next week a little bit more clothing. There's a typical woman with a veil. Not all women wore veils all the time. Here's a woman without a veil, more of a bonnet.
That's typical of men. You often see Jesus wearing these long veils. That wasn't common. It was more common when they'd be praying that a man would have that on his head. But more often, men would wear caps like this and so on. And this is an example of Jesus kind of dressed in with his. That's a mantle. That's more like you just throw it. It doesn't have the poncho effect with it. You know what I just put on for you? This is more of that throw mantle that you could use. And then, just clothing. And then we'll get into foods and so on, okay? So there's some, that's by the way, there's a meal. You see how they're reclining on their elbows? That's how you eat meals. You didn't eat up at tables like we do. All right, listen, God love you all. The kids are back. We're going to end for tonight. I hope you like this. I think we're going to, kind of continue along this vein. We'll go through next time more about clothing and foods, meals, personal hygiene. We'll look a little bit more at the domestic animals. Then we'll get into weddings, how they were done, family life and structure and so on. And then we're going to begin to look at works and trades and so on. Okay? Yeah. So we can have Father pray us out like you do. Maybe we can ask the men to help.
Good evening, brothers. Pray. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. Hail Mary,
full of grace. The Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou.